Hi, I'm Kathleen McCarthy, and you're listening to What the World Needs Now, empowered by the Holy Spirit, bringing the fire of God's love to the world. I invite you to join me in this hour of God's healing power. Call and join us in conversation and prayer. Remember, what the world needs now is God, and God is love.
And good evening and welcome to What the World Needs Now. This is your host for the next hour, Ken Johnston, and I'll be joined in just a moment by our guest. But first, I want to praise and thank God for all of our listeners out there, both for your prayerful support and your financial support as well. It's allowed us to be able to bring you shows like today's for some 40 years now. So we would just ask that, especially in this new year, that you continue to support us as best you can. With your finances, but more importantly, with your prayers, that we continue to be able to spread the word of Jesus Christ and His and the one holy Catholic Church to not only the folks here in the tri-state area in southeastern Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, and parts of Maryland, but also now around the world through our website at inhissign.com. So I'm joined today by Mr. Leo Severino, who's written a book entitled Going Deeper: A Reasoned Explanation of God and Truth. And Leo Severino has earned degrees in philosophy and law from the University of Southern California and worked as a young lawyer in the world of corporate transactions. He transitioned to filmmaking, working at 20th Century Fox before co-founding Metanoia Films. He's written and produced several feature films, including Bella and Little Boy. And this book is the fruit of years of theological studies and teaching classes on philosophy and faith. So please help me welcome to the show, Mr. Leo Severino. Hello, Leo.
Ken, how are you? Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, and thanks for joining us. I think a number of our listeners may know you from Bella, a wonderful movie that you had put out a few years back.
Thank you so much. Appreciate that, yeah.
Yeah, it was wonderful. And I got an advanced copy of the book late last week, and I have to admit I didn't get through the whole thing, but I was actually reading it on the bus on my way to the March for Life down in Washington, and it really strikes me because I think we live in a world today where there people find every excuse in the world to talk about there not being a truth, or a truth exists for may exist, but it's each individual's truth. There is no worldwide's not the word, but there's no overarching truth. And you and I and hopefully those that are listening that believe in God and especially in Jesus Christ would say that there is a truth. And I think what your book attempts to do is to show us logically. It's not you know, it's not something that we pluck out of the air or is on faith alone, but we can logically explain that truth exists, doesn't it?
That's exactly right, Ken. Yeah, it's a great summation. You know, the book starts with that notion because I kind of fell into it when I was studying philosophy, which was really deep in modern thought, surrounded, you know, was in the depth of modern thought. And it was this notion that there is no truth, not only overall truth, just any truth at all. And meaning, truth is just our subjective experience. You have your truth, I have my truth, and the one can't trump the other. And what I write in the book and what I implore all your listeners, and it isn't a matter of faith what I'm about to say, it's just a matter of sheer reason, that if someone tells you or starts with the premise, the notion that there is no truth, your immediate question should be to them, is that true? In other words, when someone is saying there is no truth, what they really are saying is that it is true that there is no truth. They are making a truth claim, and we are forced to accept that if there is no truth, cannot be true, then there must be truth, and that's where the book starts.
Amen. And it's right there. I think it's on the second page. You don't have to get too far to get to that line. And when I read it, it made absolute perfect sense that you can't say that something doesn't exist and then use it as an argument to say that it does exist.
And exactly right. Yeah, it makes instant sense to us because our intellects have been formed by God to know the truth, and so they've been imbued with these things that in logic and philosophy we call first principles. And what we're talking about here is the principle of non-contradiction. One thing cannot be the thing and its opposite and its negation at the same time. And that is something that, sadly, we have to relearn, even though it's already ingrained into our psyche, and it's something that's presumed by anyone that speaks. If someone truly believes that there is no such thing as truth, then they should never speak.
Hmm. So, again, the purpose and the reason that you decided to put pen to paper and bring this book out was because it was this sudden revelation for you, or was it something that happened over time?
Well, it was a little bit of both, right? There was a moment when I started realizing that modern philosophy is somewhat empty. I was studying in England at the time and happened to stumble upon some books that were more steeped in objective truth, and it really started opening my eyes. But over time, really, the good Lord had to get my mind before he got my heart. And so I had all these objections, and this first book, which is going to be one in the series, is meant to really go through some of the most common objections from that I had, and that I find many, many lay people have, about truth and about the existence of God and about human purpose. And I tried to make it as understandable, as approachable as I can.
So once we come to believe that there may be a truth that's out there, and that the word I was looking for was universal, that there is a universal truth out there, how do we make the leap from there being this universal truth to it beginning and ending with God?
Well, that's like the first six chapters of the book. It would be nice to try to summarize those now. But suffice it to say that if we start with the notion that there is objective truth, then as I examine in the book, we need to. It compels us to examine what can we know to be true. And from actually everyday simple events, I use the example of a leaf falling from a tree. Mm. It's just examined the causes that were necessary for that leaf to exist. It leads you down a path of logical steps that eventually leads you to God. And I'm happy to walk through some of the examples there if we have some time, Ken.
Oh, absolutely. I'm here for an hour. As long as so as much time as you want to take of that hour, you're more than welcome to.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Well, so the first example I use is that leaf falling from a tree. If you and I are sitting here, and we happen to know with absolute certainty that a leaf just fell, we witnessed it. We can empirically attest to the fact. You and I both saw this leaf fall from the tree. We might not know the exact reason why it fell. We might think it was the changing of the seasons to fall. It could have been a nibbling squirrel. It could have been a strong wind. We might not know exactly the reason. But we can know that there was something absolutely true about the fact that the leaf fell from the tree. And that is namely that it was on the tree. And if we can know that it was on the leaf and it fell from the, if it was on the tree and it fell from the tree, then we can presume and deductively deduce the fact that there has to be a tree. I mean, this might seem very obvious, and that's just the point. I was trying to make this look very obvious so that it's, these steps are irrefutable. Common sense just recognizes these things to be true. Well, if there had to be a tree, in order for there to be a branch, in order for the leaf to be on the branch, well, then there had to be a trunk. And if there had to be a trunk, there had to be a sapling. And then let's take a big leap. And if that's the case, then there had to be the earth. And that is obviously true. Well, then if we start going back, maybe our knowledge isn't exactly solid about what there was prior to the earth, right? But we can conjecture there must have been some sort of solar system and some sort of galaxy. And we keep going back and back and back. And again, at some point, our knowledge is, we're not going to know exactly what we're talking about. But suffice it to say that we can think that there had to be something that preceded something that preceded something that eventually resulted in this leaf falling from the tree. So that being the case, is there anything we can take from that that we can know to be absolutely true? Well, it turns out that there is. If there was a series of causes, a series of events that preceded the falling of the leaf, mentally we can kind of conjecture, we can kind of think, well, it could be infinitely long. For everything that there was, we can say that there was something previous to that, something previous to that, something previous to that. So we can conclude that the list of causes that preceded the falling of the leaf were infinitely long. I realize that actually there's something fundamentally wrong with that. And I'll give you two examples to try to make the point. The first is this, Ken. If I ran to your studio and I showed up at your studio and I was out of breath and I was exhausted, and you asked me where I ran from, and I said I ran from my house, and then I pointed in a direction, I said my house happens to be infinitely that way, infinitely far away, you would know that was absurd. It would be impossible for me to have crossed an infinite amount of space and time to arrive at that point. The very fact that I arrived implied that however far my house is, it couldn't be infinitely far. In the same way, Ken, if I brought with me this big basket of brownies, and I said, hey, try these brownies because they're delicious. My wife made them, and you asked me for the recipe, and I said, oh, it's really easy. It's an infinitely long list of ingredients. You would likewise know that that's an absurd claim. The very fact that we're eating the brownies implies that however many ingredients were required to make the brownie, the list could not be infinitely long. People would still be forever collecting ingredients before you get to the baking. The fact that you're biting into the brownie implies that it is a closed set, that everything that was necessary to cause it has already happened. What does this have to do with our falling leaf? Well, the answer is everything. If the leaf fell, that means, like the running of the house, it couldn't have crossed an infinite amount of space and time. All the causes that were necessary to make it couldn't have expanded across an infinity because it would have never arrived. Just like the brownies, everything that was required to make the leaf fall from the tree has already happened, which means the list, however long it is, cannot be infinitely long, which means it must be finite. Well, if it's finite, that means in theory, we might not know exactly what the causes are, but we could count them, we could quantify them. We would say there was a thousandth cause in the list of causes, and a hundredth, and then a tenth, and then a third, a second, and a first. We would then get to this thing called the first cause. And this first cause is a very, very interesting thing indeed, because unlike every cause that follows after it, there's no cause before it. And now we're getting something that is extraordinary, something that is radically different than everything that came after it. And from there, the leap to God is actually quite simple. Does that make sense, Ken?
Oh, it makes perfect sense to me, but I'm a believer. But so when you
weren't, it should make perfect sense.
No, it does. But when you, so I guess where the argument comes in, and where we run into people that may not believe in God or try to argue that there is no God, it comes down to that first cause then. And whether that first cause was God or something else, and that's where I meant, where faith comes in to a degree. I mean, to me, as somebody that would believe in God, it has to believe that that first cause was not random or chaotic. You just look at the human body and you look at things in nature and how ordered they are, as opposed to being disordered. That there had to be something logical or something with a logical mind or what have you behind it, that all this could never be random. And so
that's right.
So for me, that it's obvious to me that, well, that's God, God in his infinite wisdom, designed everything from every hair on my head to the sand on the beach to the animals and plants and everything else. But when you use the logic to get to the first cause, what's the leap from first cause to God?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because it turns out that it is. I wrote this book in part to show that it isn't just a matter of blind faith. It isn't just a matter of, well, at some point reason has to take the back seat, and then faith is going to kick in, and we're going to get the belief in God. I actually believe, as the entire tradition of the church has, in certain cases, infallibly taught, that God can actually be known at some level by, for example, the fact that he exists in some of his properties by the sheer light of reason, right? To know the inner workings of the Holy Trinity, well, of course, that's a matter of faith. That's beyond our pay grades because of the nature of our intellects and the nature of God. But to know that he exists, even in the scriptures, it says God can be known by the things he created, and this is one way. So if we get to this first cause, well, then something very interesting happens. Because it's the first cause, that means it is not preceded by any cause previous to it. If it's not preceded by any cause previous to it, that means this first cause is uncaused. Oh, that doesn't make much sense to us by way of our experience. Everything around us in this universe can be traceable to some sort of cause. Any word that we speak, any thought that we have, any physical thing that we witness, anything that we sense with our senses, we can trace it, just like with the falling leaf, to some sort of cause previous to it, right? Which must mean that this first cause is unlike everything that came after it. because this first cause exists, we know it's necessary to exist because we fell. But nothing caused it to exist. It is uncaused. So what we have here is an uncaused first cause that is in the causal chain of everything that happens after it. Now we start expanding a little bit the picture. From here, you can actually prove deductively, you can prove a bunch of things. You can prove that there can only be one first cause. You can prove that this first cause is completely and utterly self-sufficient, which means it needs nothing either to create nor to exist. You can prove that this thing is insanely powerful because what is true of the falling leaf is true of every single thing that ever has or ever will happen in the entire universe. You can prove that this thing created without any pre-existing matter. If there were pre-existing stuff that the first cause then molded to create the universe, well, where did that stuff come from? Well, you need another cause for that stuff. And then what did that previous cause use to create that? And you'd be in this infinite rabbit hole of an infinite regression, and you would never get to the falling leaf. So you can prove all these things actually deductively, and that's what I do in the first few chapters of the book, is I go step by step through each of these, which are really, really seem very complicated concepts, but there's actually very, very, very simple, very palatable, very digestible ways to know these truths. And once we get there, once we've established a long list of these things, well, from there to the leap of this God is the thinking God that created on purpose, really just flows logically. It's not a matter of I need to take a leap of faith. It really is right there, immediately visible in front of one.
Very good. And I can tell, like I said, with the advanced copy I got of the book, that I haven't read the whole thing, but what Leo is saying, my brothers and sisters, is 100% accurate, and that he puts it in this language that even I can understand. And so while Leo has a number of degrees and what have you, myself as a college dropout, could completely understand the way this book is written. If you get into debates and arguments with friends, family members, coworkers about the truth and the existence of God, I can assure you that picking up this book, you'll be able to logically deduce, just as he's laying it out for us here on the radio, in a great way that he does it in the book, that you'll be able to comprehend it and really explain it. And what I get out of it, and because of my background in the recovery world and dealing with folks that suffer with alcoholism and drug addiction, and one of the examples that's used a lot is electricity, that, you know, most people today can't explain what electricity is, and yet it's flowing through all of our houses, all of our places of work, and we just expect when you turn the light on, you know, when you flip the switch, that the light's going to come on. And the example you used in the book of the white powder that's on a table in a restaurant, and, you know, when we walk in, you know, you sit down at a restaurant or you go to someone's house and sit down at their table, you know what's that white stuff is on the table, and you automatically pick it up and sprinkle it on your food and, you know, hope, you know, expect it to enhance the flavor the way it always does. And yet that white substance doesn't necessarily have to be salt, does it? It could be anthrax, it could be flour, it could be cocaine, it could be any number of things other than salt. And yet we just, because of our experience, we assume that it's salt. And I think as we walk through our lives daily, and I've actually done this a couple times after reading this in the book, that if you take a few minutes as you're going through life, and the things that we do on a daily basis are all around truth, aren't they? Whether they're implied or experiential or somehow or other, we've just come to believe that these things are true, that if we don't look at it that way, if we don't spend, you know, take a few minutes, you know, we can miss truth altogether. But if we take a few minutes and just, you know, everything we do in life is based on these truths that we have in our own lives. And like you said, if we trace them back, we get back to the first cause.
Ken, that's wonderful. And it's an incredible summation. Thank you for that. And I think that's right. I think on both sides of the equation, I think the non-believers relegate God to just a matter of kind of faith and superstition, nothing that, you know, reason can actually come to. And then in many ways, believers as well, right? They think faith is just blind faith. I believe because I believe, as opposed to doing what the very scriptures tell us to do, which is examine our beliefs and test them and hold on to that which is true. And so I you're exactly right. If little things as trivial as the truth of a white powder inside a salt container or a salt shaker are important, how much more important are the truths that are fundamental? Truths about our not only existence of God, but our purpose relative to God, what our life is about, you know, our behavior, our ethics, those sorts of things. And those are the sorts of things I try to tackle in the book.
Right. And it's funny, you know, I got a couple of friends. We see things happen in life and we say, is that odd or is that God? Because we know that it's God acting in our lives. And just as you said that, I happened to open the book to chapter 14, The Purpose of Life. And now that we have a semblance of truth and we believe that there is a first cause and that first cause is God, how does that affect our purpose in life?
Well, since we have the time, Ken, let me fill in one gap between there, right? From the first cause to purpose actually implies something. It implies that the universe, that the creation, the first cause created and caused things to exist on purpose, that it wasn't accidental. In other words, it implies that the first cause designed everything, that the first cause thinks. And there's so many ways to conclude that the first cause thinks. But again, as it's laid out in the scriptures, God, in this aspect of him, is actually knowable from the things he created, says St. Paul. So I gave a couple of examples, and I'm going to running through a couple of them with you, Ken, to show that from this creator, we can see that it is necessary to conclude by inductive logic that this first cause is also one that thinks, that this wasn't an accident, right?
Yep.
And I use a couple of examples in the book. Imagine this. Imagine you and I are NASA scientists, and we are charged with trying to find intelligence in the universe outside of Earth. We're trying to see if there's life, if there's intelligent life in some other planet. We have a telescope, and we're looking up deep somewhere into outer space and in some far galaxy, and on a planet that we can recognize as somewhat habitable by the conditions of its proximity to a star or whatever else, its size and density. Maybe we start seeing on that planet, we start focusing in and we see and we notice that there is something that looks like matter. And actually the matter seems to be moving in a shifting pattern. And we can start discerning that pattern actually is forming into blocks. And the blocks are forming one on top of another in this meticulous, very intricate weave of a pattern. And then we start looking more, and over time we start organizing the data, and we start realizing, actually, there's some energy that is flowing through these blocks, and it's lighting up across different blocks as these things are forming, and it's lighting up in a way that is a discernible pattern, that we can actually now predict what the very next light block that's going to light up is going to be because of the previous lights and because of the pattern that we've discerned. And in fact, we conclude, this is a language. We can actually read this. We can interpret this. We would conclude 100% without a shadow of doubt, this is no accident. The intelligibility of the patterns, the fact that it's self-forming, the fact that we can read it as a language, the fact that we can predict it, the fact of its complexity, all these things would make us as scientists conclude this is no accident. This didn't just happen. Pebbles of sand don't just form themselves in this way, in these intelligible patterns that we can recognize as a language. We would conclude, finally, the answer to this big mystery of the universe has been solved by us, right? There is life on other planets. There is intelligent life behind these patterns. And so we would probably try to communicate with whatever intelligent life was behind these patterns. I don't think it's very controversial. In fact, there's a whole group called SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, that is trying to do just that. And they've concluded the possibility of intelligence with far less complicated structures and patterns than what I've described. Mm. Now, Ken, let's take our eyes off of that telescope and let's put our eyes on top of a microscope, and we're looking down at the micron level, and we see the same thing. Imagine we saw shifting forms, and we saw these forms forming into interwoven building blocks that are forming upon themselves, that have this energy running through it, and it has this pattern. This pattern is predictable, and this pattern is replicable, and we can read it as a language. What you're looking at is DNA. Mm. DNA is a code that has been cracked. DNA is intelligible. DNA is a pattern. DNA is a language. the exact same thing that we would conclude if we saw it through a telescope, that this was no accident, there was intelligence behind it. Why don't scientists, actually the majority of them do, but why do many people claim that it's not the case when you're looking at it under a microscope, when you're seeing the exact same thing? The point what I'm trying to point to is this notion of embedded intelligence. If something requires intelligence to decipher, if something in and of itself has an intelligible pattern, the conclusion is that it took intelligence to put that intelligence, to embed that intelligence into the very thing. We use this assumption all the time. If you and I were playing Scrabble and one of us accidentally knocked over the tiles and the tiles landed in a random, unintelligible way, we wouldn't make anything of it. But if we knocked it over and they landed in such a way that it spelled out, you know, one of Shakespeare's sonnets, we would not for a second think that that was accidental. You know, we'd be looking around the room to see who's practically joking us. There has to be some intelligence behind this. Hmm. Well, DNA is so much more complicated and intelligible than all of Shakespeare's works combined. In fact, just it takes an artist incredible skill and mastery and intelligence to draw a painting of a flower. If we came across a painting of a flower, we would never conclude that that was accidental, that paint just happened to randomly splatter into this form on a canvas that looks like a flower. If it takes intelligence to make the painting of a flower, how much more to make an actual flower? And these examples are plethora, and there's just but one way to conclude that the first cause who caused the existence of all these things also thinks.
Awesome. That's awesome. And it actually brings us to the bottom of the hour. Can I give out our numbers, Leo, and take phone calls? Do you have some time to spend with
great.
Us? Okay. I'll not guarantee anybody's going to call, but if you happen to be listening and you have a question for Leo Severino about the truth and God and his book Going Deeper, A Reasoned Exploration of God and Truth, pick up your phone and give us a call, 610-527-2906, 610-527-2906. Or if you're listening through our website and want to call toll-free, it's 888-343-2484. That's 888-34-FAITH. We're just going to take a short break, Leo, and then we'll be back. Don't go away.
We thank God for our one, holy, Catholic and Apostolic Church, where Jesus remains present to us until the end of the age, in word and in sacrament. Catholic Radio shares in the ministry of the Church to proclaim the gospel to the ends of the earth. And in his sign, Catholic Radio, has been doing so for over 30 years. Kathleen McCarthy and In His Sign have been empowered by the Holy Spirit to bring the fire of God's healing love to the world through Catholic radio and the internet. With God's grace, His word goes out, healing hearts and transforming lives. In His Sign proclaims the culture of life loud and clear in a culture of death. The ministry's mission is to evangelize, catechize, and to be a voice for those who have no voice, proclaiming the truth that will set all people free. To our faithful family and friends who stand with us, thank you for being missionaries with us by supporting In His Sign Catholic Radio. Without your monthly support of prayer and financial giving, our mission would not be able to continue. Our mission voice would be silenced. To our new listeners, please prayerfully consider joining our monthly circle of family and friends by partnering with us financially each month. All donations are completely tax deductible and go directly to our daily expenses, like the purchase of radio airtime and keeping the lights on. Kathleen McCarthy and all of the staff at In His Sign, except Kathleen's administrator, donate all of their time and talent on a volunteer basis at no expense to the ministry. Donations to In His Sign Catholic Radio may be sent to 136 Garrett Avenue, Rosemont, PA 19010. Or you can donate securely at inhissign.com. Remember, without your prayers and financial support, our mission voice will be silenced.
And welcome back to What the World Needs Now. It's your host, Ken Johnston, for the next 27 and a half minutes or so. And today's guest is Mr. Leo Severino, and we've been talking about his book, Going Deeper, A Reasoned Exploration of God and Truth. It's published by Ignatius, so it's readily available at Ignatius.com and other book retailers. The first segment, we talked about really the beginning of the book and what is truth and how we can logically deduce the truth does exist. And before we went to the break, we were leading up to the purpose of life and how we can proceed from realizing that truth exists and prove that it exists, and then it from there to an intelligible person whom we would call God, and then that in turn would transform into a purpose for our lives. And I think that's where we're going to pick up again. Leo's got about another 10 minutes or so to spend with us. So in 10 minutes, Leo, can you answer, what is the purpose of life?
It sounds so arrogant to even attempt a response, but the answer is yes, I can.
There you go. Yeah, man.
Because this stuff is already, all the work has been done. Mm-hmm. 2 millennia of church teaching. In fact, it's page 1 of the catechism. We'll tell you right there what the purpose of life is. Yeah. But you're right. Once we establish that there is truth and that leads us inevitably to God if we're people of goodwill, and we realize that God is not compelled to create. Nothing can cause the first cause to cause anything because the first cause is uncaused. Well, then kind of purpose is built in already to it. In other words, the creation couldn't have been for the benefit of the creator because there's no need in God to create. So it has to be to some benefit of the creation. So there's purpose kind of built into it. But the way we can actually get, I think in a more intelligible way, the way we can get to the purpose of God is to actually, the purpose of our life is to actually presume the opposite. Let's presume that there is no first cause, there's just randomness. All there was matter, and it was a long time ago. There was nothing, and nothing somehow exploded. And then over time, just by random accident, these things started coalescing at really, really high speeds and high temperatures. And then all of a sudden, there was a nuclear force and then a gravitational force. And then over time, light is emitting from that distant explosion in such a way that it starts forming into things that we now recognize as galaxies, and then amongst them there's solar systems, and one of them just randomly happens to have fit the conditions for life because of this medium-sized star, which is our sun, and then there's a planet that just happened to have randomly accidentally coalesced into this form that is perfect for the generation of this primordial ooze, and then let's say lightning struck, and then out of that there was our organic life that when the ooze dried up happened to survive because it landed on its legs that became feet, and then it became upright, and then it recognized itself as conscience at some point in this process, this random mechanical accidental process, and then eventually here we are, right? Let's presume that, which is a very, very common, sadly, concept that is being taught in colleges and universities everywhere. In other words, what we're saying is the universe is ultimately meaningless because it is random. Using the example of the Scrabble board again, if we dropped it and the pieces dropped randomly, we wouldn't say that's meaningful. It would have to be intelligible. It would have to be designed at some level for it to be truly meaningful. Right? So the whole universe is accidental, which means the whole universe is just this random collection of stuff that happens to be in this particular form. which means it's ultimately meaningless. So if that's the case, well, then life, which is the random byproduct of a meaningless accidental universe, is also accidental, which means it's also purposeless. It's also meaningless. And that's where we come across our first problem. The universe is meaningless. That means life is meaningless. But if life is meaningless, that means thought is also meaningless. It's a meaningless byproduct of a meaningless life. That's a byproduct of a meaningless universe. Thought is also just random and accidental, which means there's no meaning to thought. In other words, if the universe is meaningless, that means life is meaningless. If life is meaningless, that means thought is meaningless. And if thought is meaningless, then the very thought that life is meaningless. In other words, if we start with the presumption that the universe itself is just random and accidental, that means the very thought that the universe is random and accidental is also random and accidental. And we have no reason to believe it. We are stuck if we believe that anything is intelligible with the fact that the universe is intelligible. If the universe is intelligible, when where does that intelligibility come from? Well, we know there has to have been a first cause and it has to be intelligible. So there's purpose already kind of baked in to the very act of creation. Well, then, how are we going to know that purpose? I think I've got 5 minutes left, Ken. Let me try, if that's okay with you.
Yep.
Thank you. So then, once we conclude there has to be a purpose or a meaning to life, well, then how are we going to find that out? Well, how do we know the meaning and the purpose of anything? I'm currently speaking in a cell phone to you. I know the purpose of this cell phone, not because of its usage. I can use a cell phone as a paperweight, and it serves as a very, very, very good paperweight. But I know by looking at the thing that it's not meant to be a paperweight, because it has functionalities that go far beyond what any other paperweight can do, texting and calling, et cetera, right? Well, I know, cut to the chase, the purpose of this telephone because of its design. In the same way, I challenge all your listeners to look around. If you know the purpose of anything, that purpose is intrinsically linked to its design. The purpose of a chair, we know because of its design. We know that someone thought through the fact of how our legs bend, et cetera, and weight, and they developed seats, chairs, to be recognizable as chairs, having a very particular design. This is true of everything. Anything whose purpose we know because of its design. Well, if that's true, and we wanted to ask what the purpose of human life is, the very next logical question is, well, what is our design? What is it in the way that we are created that makes us different, unique, special? Right? Is that the fact that we take space is not just particular to our design. Mountains do that even better than us. So the fact that we can run fast, well, cheetahs run faster than us. But there's two things I would claim. That we, by our design, do better than everything else out there that we know of. The first is our ability to reason, our ability to know, our ability to think, our intellects. Right? Even if we give rudimentary thought to animals, let's presume, nothing compares to the very fact that we can make big old radio towers that can send out signals into the ether so that people can hear our voices in an intelligible way. I mean, we can outthink just about everything else out there. Something in our intelligence, in our ability to know, points to some design in us that is fulfilled in the purpose of knowing. And it's not just knowing. It's taking bare concept, abstractions in our minds, and then causing something out into the universe. We can not only think of the thought of a radio station and a radio tower, we can actually make one, we can actually create one. There's something in this purposeful cause, which what I call is the ability, in the book I mentioned it as the ability to choose. It's our will. It's our ability to not only think about something, but to cause it. Just like the first cause causes, there's something in us as well that has the ability to cause. Just as the first cause thinks, there's something in us that has this ability to think. It's almost kind of as if we're made in the image and likeness of God. And it turns out that that's where our purpose resides. Our purpose has to do with knowing and causing, that is, choosing certain things. Well, knowing and choosing what? Well, ultimately, knowing and choosing stuff that's in accordance with our purpose. But here's the rub. Whatever the purpose of human life is, it would have to be something that is applicable to every single person that ever has or ever will exist. Any single person who has the design of a human would have the exact purpose. And there's only one category of things that we know applies to everything that to every single person that has or ever will exist. And that is, it's not this Earth. We could put somebody in a capsule and shoot them up in the outer space, they still have the same design. The only thing that's applicable to everyone is God himself. And so I contend in the book, and it's actually a dogma of our faith, that the purpose of life is to know and to choose, that is, to love God.
Amen. And let's see, we've done that in less than 40 minutes because we had a commercial in between and what have you. And the book, like I said before, the limited amount of it that I have read, it's well laid out. It's not a simple read, but you don't have to be have a doctorate degree to understand it. And Leo does a great job of laying out exactly what we've been talking about in this book. So whether it's for yourself or somebody else that you debate with about the existence of God, I think this is a wonderful book to pick up and just offer it to people, because if they have any logic in them whatsoever, as most human beings do, they may come up with the same conclusion that we already have. The last question I had for you, Leo, before you go, is you mentioned that this was the first in a series of books that you hope to put out. Have you started? I'm assuming you've started working on the next one already.
I have. I have indeed. Yep, I have indeed. There's a couple of chapters that are fully complete, and I'm actually already in skeletal form into the third book. So hopefully we'll have these two coming out soon.
Very good. And I hope when they do that Ignatius gets in touch with us again, and we can have you back to talk about them. So
I hope so too. Thank you, Ken. I appreciate it. Thanks for all your good work. God bless you, brother.
You too. We appreciate it, and I hope our paths cross again soon. Best of luck with this book and with the future books. Keep them coming.
Thank you, pal. Appreciate it.
All right. Be good. God bless you. So our guest today has been Mr. Leo Severino, and the book we've been talking about was Going Deeper, A Reasoned Exploration of God and Truth, available at Ignatius.com. Ignatius Press is the author, and I'm sure you can pick it up other spots. There's available an electronic copy as well, so whether it's the Kindle or the ebook off Ignatius' website, many ways to get it. And like I said, I started to read it on the bus trip down to the March for Life on Friday, and got interrupted a number of times, so I didn't get too far into it. But the logic that he uses, it just makes, at least for me, who sometimes has difficulty comprehending what I've read because of the number of brain cells I've burned out in my youth, but I can make sense of this. And so I'd encourage you, if you're always wondering, what truth is and how do we logically deduce and get back to truth. And then what he does so well is then, once we believe that truth has to exist, that the next conclusion is that, that it begins with God. And then once we believe that that God is truth, then the next step is to how do we interact with God? How do we interact with this truth? And we interact with it on a daily basis, whether we recognize it or not. And like so much in life, we take for granted. And I just encourage you, even if it's for 15 minutes tonight and some of the daily things that you do, the assumptions that we make as we go through life are many. And each one individually is a truth, whether we acknowledge it at the time or not. So we have about 15 minutes left. And like I said, I had the wonderful opportunity on Friday to head down to Washington, D.C. with a busload of folks from my home parish, St. Luke's in Glenside. We had a little contingent that came over from St. Albert the Great and joined us. And just a wonderful day, I think, had by all this on the 45th anniversary of that fateful decision of Roe versus Wade and the impact that it's had on so many people over the last 45 years. But the weather was awesome, which I think led to there being a great crowd that was there. And I know that things are not random in this world, because just the people that you happen to see and meet while you're there, it turns out one of the fellows that happened to get on the bus is a gentleman I've been on retreat with now the last couple of years out at Malvern. And he recognized me, and I had to apologize because I didn't recognize Martin right away, but we You know, we got to talking only for a minute before when we first arrived at the march, and then actually rode home, sitting next to him, and had a great conversation on the way back. But even while marching along there in Washington, one of our great hosts here on Monday, Brian Gale, I got to know his son Brian a couple of years ago, and I hadn't seen him in a while. And sure enough, I'm walking up and spotted Brian. It was great to see him and his smiling face, one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. And great to see him and doing well. I shot back a picture to Brian, and it was just awesome. I saw a former bishop from Philadelphia, and now the Bishop of Arlington, Virginia, Bishop Michael Burbidge. And Father McKay, who's my co-host here in the 4 o'clock hour, in that book, Anointing Echoes, it was actually Bishop Burbidge who wrote the foreword to the book. And I got to play intermediary. Sometimes I get to be Father McKay's secretary. So I played a little role in asking and transmitting back and forth the transcripts of the book. So I had an opportunity to thank Bishop Burbidge in person. On Friday, and I'd like to report that he looks great, doing well, and just a great guy. You know, I knew when he left that we would miss him, and he's apparently doing real well there in Arlington. Also saw Bishop Senior along the way, and a few of our seminarians. And unfortunately, the way our bus works is we leave after 6:30 Mass at St. Luke's. So we don't get down to Washington in time for Archbishop Chaput's Mass at the Basilica, but always have an opportunity to pop into the Basilica, usually at the tail end of his Mass, and was blessed to have a few minutes when we got back from the march to go to the Adoration Chapel there and spend a few minutes with our Lord before we got on the bus to come home. So in some ways, it was an awesome day to have the rally addressed by both the President and Vice President of the United States, saying all the right things. Again, we need to keep it up on prayer. We need to keep the pressure on our representatives in Congress and the Senate to continue to do what they've promised to do. They talk a great game. We're still waiting for them to do a number of things that they promised, like defunding Planned Parenthood and what have you. So while it was great to have them inspire the crowd and get them whooped up and ready to march, we still have a long way to go in terms of the pro-life movement. I had heard somebody on another show talking about, you know, how after 45 years that they've given up, that they've been at it for as long as they can remember, and they don't see anything changing. Well, I see things changing. The law may not have changed, but to see that crowd that was there on Friday, rather, was the biggest of the crowd since I've been going in the last six, seven years or so. It gets younger and younger every year. A couple of the folks that went with us either went to Notre Dame or had kids that went to Notre Dame, and was happy to see that Notre Dame had sent 15% of their student population, over 1,000 college kids from the campus of Notre Dame, down to the march. The number of young vocations that are there, especially the young nuns in habit, and just the glow and the shine on their face, and how they bring the young people to the march is just—it's just awesome, and it does. It gives you hope, and you know, you hear it all the time—the chanting that's going on, that we are the pro-life generation, and that's the generation that's coming after me. And you know, some people have asked them why they march and why they've become part of the pro-life movement, and you know, it's. Interesting, and it's odd that their response would be that they're happy that they weren't aborted, with the number of abortions that have taken place over the last 45 years since the passing of Roe v. Wade, that To think that some of our young people actually feel that they were lucky to be born at all is a sad commentary on life here in the United States and around the world. But more and more, we are seeing a movement towards the idea that life matters and that every life matters. But we still have a long way to go. And even those that are in the pro-life generation and the young people that, are so pro-life. I know that times come and difficulties come in their life. And sometimes you can be as pro-life as anyone can be. But when you're faced with that unplanned pregnancy and the fear comes in, fear of having to tell your parents or fear of having to tell your the gentleman that impregnated you, the fear of having the financial resources to raise a child. All these fears come about. And when you go to solicit advice and the advice comes back that, you know, if you have an abortion, it'll take care of this issue. I think that, like I say, you could be as pro-life as they come. You can be one of these young people that marches all the time. But when you're faced with that decision, you know, sometimes abortion can look like a viable option. And, you know, once you head down that path, you know, once there's one, then the second one's easier. The third one's easier than the second one. And you head down a path. And the reason I bring that up is I don't know if I've discussed it here before. I may have, but back in the September time frame, I was invited to come over to Bishop McDevitt High School and address the juniors in their theology classes about decision making. And somebody in their infinite wisdom thought that I'd be a great person to come in and talk to young people about the impact of making bad decisions in your life. Can you imagine that, me? And like I've made bad decisions in my life. But seriously, the person that recommended it knows a little bit about my background and deduced from that, that I must have made some bad decisions along the way. And I would start my discussion with these juniors, and I asked two simple questions. I said to the girls, how many of you can't wait to get pregnant and have an abortion? Now, these are juniors, so they're 15, 16 years old. And they looked at me, then they looked at each other. I could hear them murmuring to each other, what's he talking about? Who is this guy? What's he talking about? What do you mean, do I want to get pregnant and have an abortion? And then I didn't answer them. So then I addressed the boys, and I said, how many of you boys can't wait to get married and get divorced? And now all of them, looking at each other, looking at me, turning around, looking at the moderator of the class. And now they're all chirping. You know, who is this guy? What's he talking about? Where are you going with this? So I said it again, seriously. How many of you can't wait to have an abortion? How many of you can't wait to get divorced? Not a single person. And that's obvious. It's just like when we were talking to Leo Severino about truth. And that's something that's ingrained with us when, as a very young person. Nobody plans to have an abortion. Nobody coming up, you know, says, you know, I can't wait to get married. And better yet, I can't wait to get divorced and maybe get married a second time. So what happens along the way that half of our marriages end up in divorce and 65 million babies are aborted? How does that happen? And it's because somewhere along the line, people with great expectations, people with great hope, people that know intrinsically that abortion is wrong, people that know that intrinsically, they know just because of there being a child of God created in the image and likeness of God, that a man is meant to marry a woman and a woman to marry a man, and that they together that they have children, they see that, they recognize it, and they know what the truth is in those situations. Yet something happens along the way that leads to the turmoil that we see in life today. especially here in the United States, in this culture of death, and in this culture in general, that, you know, somewhere along the line we decide that we're going to have sex, and it's could be before we're married, after we're married, either hoping that a baby won't result, or using some form of birth control or contraception with the idea that there's no way I'm going to get pregnant. But in any event, all of a sudden somebody's pregnant, and this wasn't planned, and it's now what? I know in many cases, it's not the woman that chooses the abortion. It's the man that impregnated her. I think in a lot of cases, we men are as much to blame, if not more to blame, than the women are. If we choose not to offer support and to, you know, tell them that they need to take care of this problem, that sometimes the only option that a woman may see that she has is to have that abortion. And one of the most beautiful things that's going on today is the other options that have been made available. These pregnancy crisis centers, the helplines and hotlines, the houses that have been designated for unwed mothers and those that have unexpected pregnancies, and the support that's available, and the beauty of the, you know, our sidewalk folks outside of these abortion clinics, that when they can get the ear of somebody and let them know that there is another option. And a lot of times that may be all it needs, that, you know, as the woman is approaching the clinic, that the only option she thinks she has is to have an abortion. And just by getting a second option, that life may be able to come about. But I've said it before and I'll say it again. The biggest issue I have with the pro-choice movement is that they refuse to tell men and women the long-lasting effects of what abortion has on lives. It's not just the life of that the life of that baby that's terminated. A lot of times the life of the woman and the man, the life that they've been leading up to that point is terminated. It often results in addiction and suicide and other things. And they're not those aren't the things that are listed or told to these folks when they come to a clinic and seek out an abortion. So we need to continue to rally for life, to rally for an end to the culture of death, to rally for pro-life, not just for our infants, but for those at the end of their lives, that they be treated with respect and allowed the beauty of a natural death. So we'll continue to fight the good fight here at In His Sign, and we ask you to continue to fight that good fight with us. I want to thank you again for being with me for whatever portion of these 2 hours you gave us. Remember, you can always listen to the broadcast online at our website at inhissign.com, and I look forward to being with you again next Wednesday. Until then, take care, and God bless.